Welcome to Life on the Illinois Prairie. Your host is Wendy Fleming Dexter, and after 30 years living in small town Illinois, she has stories to tell. Past cornfields and factories, into the heart of Amish country. There's more here than what meets the eye, far beyond what you think you know. So buckle up and stay tuned. This is Life on the Illinois Prairie.
Hi, and welcome to this episode of Life on the Illinois Prairie. I'm your host, Wendy Fleming Dexter. I have a returning guest today who's been kind enough to come back. He's been on a couple of times. I know you'll recognize his name and his voice. Welcome back, meteorologist Jacob Dickey from Channel 3 WCIA.
Hey, Wendy. How are we doing?
Doing great, Jacob. Thank you so much. As always, I mean, I thank everybody for coming on here because they're all busy, but I swear you are the busiest guy around. And so if you could just give some background information so people who don't know who you are, and I don't know who those people are who've lived under a rock, but if you, there are people that do listen from not the local area. So if you give a little background information, that'd be great.
Yeah, so I've been born and raised in Central Illinois from Gibson City, and graduated from high school here. Went to the University of Illinois for undergrad, and then went to my grad school down at Mississippi State. And my undergrad was in the College of Aces. I was going to be an ag teacher and loved what FFA did. Just came around to where, you know, didn't join FFA till high school. I've loved the weather since I was 2-3 years old. And so the full circle came around and got my grad school master's degree in professional meteorology and went the broadcast route. Have a history here at Channel 3. I was a kidcaster way back in fifth grade, and that was 2003. And then I was a weather watcher for Judy Frazier. The kidcaster was Robert Reese. Then with Derek Faber, I interned while in college here, kind of get my foot in the door and, you know, make sure I was, you know, ag teaching. Was that what I wanted to do, or did I really want to keep the weather path going? And now I work for Kevin. So that's four of the five chief meteorologists that the station has had I've been a part of, which is really cool. And from here, I have a lot of connections and know people and love Central Illinois, and I'm happy to be in the job that I am.
Well, and being in the job that you are not, you're one of those people, you're not just a meteorologist, you are involved on many levels in the community. One of those levels that you have been involved in is through the Community Foundation of East Central Illinois of Champaign. And recently, Matt Toon, unfortunately, became under a do not drink order. There had been two of them. They were back to back. First, they said that it was okay to come back to it, to drink the water. And it wasn't just that people could not drink the water, that they could not bathe in it or cook with it, and they couldn't boil it to make it safe. So could you address how you became involved in that and the fact that you are able to get information out to people in a way that the community didn't seem to be able to do it, the city?
Yeah, so we'll start with the Community Foundation. The CEO and president of that is Allison Winter, and she's got deep ties to the U of I, and she's from this area as well. She's Champaign County. Her family has connections up in Melvin, which is in the same school district that I grew up in. So she's also from Central Illinois. And it was the last spring of 2024, she wanted a meeting with me, and I didn't really know much. And, you know, she said, "Hey, we've got the Community Foundation of East Central Illinois. You know, I'd like to talk to you more about opportunities and things like that." And I remember being, "Okay, yeah, I'll do that. That's fine. We'll squeeze that in. We'll get coffee." And I can't remember what happened that day. She says that I bailed out on her. I think we had some severe weather pop up last second, and I just got sidetracked from that. So I kind of blew her off, is what she tells people. And so we rescheduled the meeting. It was like maybe 2 weeks later, because it was just crazy busy. And I was like, "Oh crap, you know, I forgot about that. I need to reach out again." And so then we ended up getting a coffee and pastry, and we talked about what the Community Foundation does. And they were looking for new board members. She was new to the organization. She was basically in her first year, and her task was to I don't want to say transform or modernize, but, you know, she's a creative breath of fresh air. And so, you know, they were wanting to get more representation from across the region. The Community Foundation covers 9 counties. They're Ford County all the way down to Coles County, and then in between you go from Piatt County to the state line. So they've got a bit of an area that they cover with their funds. And I like to tell people that it's similar to, if you've ever played Monopoly, the community chest that's in Monopoly. Mm. Oh, you get some money from that, or, you know, that's how you kind of get things. That's kind of what they are. They're a hub for money for different community organizations, different efforts, things of that. And they do not operate as what you would think traditionally a nonprofit would operate as. What they do is they support nonprofits and communities, and they receive funds through endowments and through other things like that. So people will donate a pot of money, and that money is designed to continue to give every year after year after year. It's not a one-time contribution. Mm. So some of their grants they've gotten, some of their funds that people have given, you know, they give a sum of money, then the principal that, you know, basically the money they give stays there, and then whatever they make on top from interest or things of that is then redistributed. So for example, if you did, and these are just some made up numbers here, I'm on the board, I'm not the actual, you know, bolts in the ground working on things. But, you know, if somebody were to donate $5,000, then they'd probably be able to every year give $250 from that pot. And that's continuous year after year after year after year after you give. And so it's kind of neat how they do things. They don't give money directly to people, if that makes sense, but they support a lot of the nonprofits that are in communities. They're connected with most all of them across nine counties. And every area is covered by a community foundation. There's also the Community Foundation in Southeastern Illinois. That's in it's the Southeastern Illinois Community Foundation. That's in Effingham. You've got the Heart of Illinois one in Decatur, and then you've got one in Springfield. And they cover different service areas, and there's some overlap and things of that. So really neat what they do. And when we were talking about it, I was like, yeah, I'm really interested in this. I think this is really cool. So I've been on their board now, just entering my second year of my first term of that. And I've really enjoyed it. It's been nice insight into what goes on around Central Illinois. And that's kind of how we fell into what we were able to do in the past couple of weeks around here.
Well, and you and being in that position, not as though you don't know enough people through what you've already done, but being in that position and meeting, you know, chambers of commerce presidents and other people in the area that are so influential, that has to give you even more insight into what each community goes through, and in this particular case, what Matt Toon had gone through. So, how I know that when you had first put the link on there for people to contribute and feel like they had some, you know, I guess the term a lot of times is skin in the game, people that can contribute and feel like they're helping in a way monetarily, and that really grew. And there was matching money in that also?
Yeah, so I think kind of the idea that I had for a while is, and there's still some things working in the background that, you know, we don't know totally how it'll turn out, but I was like, you know, the Community Foundation can really be a kind of a hub. A lot of times after a disaster or an event that might require some funding that affects a community, a lot of times it's usually more responsive. It's, what do you need? Okay, now let's start to raise money. I'm like, you know what? Mm-hmm. The moment something happens, I mean, the moment we see a town get hit by a tornado, the moment there's a big explosion and people are displaced, like, we clearly know that there's a need. Mm-hmm. We might not know exactly what that need looks, but it's obvious that there's a need. And I think it looked different for Matching than it might for most other things, kind of how things started set up. But we could use that as a way to start fundraising for those efforts. And the Community Foundation as well, they're very reputable. They're very credible. They have 30 million in assets, I think is what the number is. You know, it's not just a GoFundMe, if that makes sense. So there's a lot of benefits in that being a accredited nonprofit that works with nonprofits. You know, they're plugged in. So the Community Foundation can be that hub to connect people to the actual community in the ground. And, you know, I thought to myself, let's just try this. They actually have these funds that are set up, and they're really not used a whole lot. They're county-based funds. And a county fund is basically was just set up by, you know, we've got this. If people want to donate towards a cause in Douglas County or Coles County or Ford County or, you know, Vermillion County, Piatt County, whatever it is, they're just kind of sitting there. So I kind of, you know, I'm a firm believer in ask for forgiveness, don't ask for permission, if that makes sense. And so I just said, you know, this is Coles County Fund. This is the intent of that. Let's just throw this up. And I put it up, I think, at 10:30 at night, because I'm like, you know, whether it's people don't have access to water, I mean, that's a pretty big thing, or it's businesses being impacted, the economic impact from this crisis, I think you're way bigger than most people realize, from all your small businesses that couldn't serve food and had to shut down, and you know, the factories that were affected, things of that. Whatever it is, there's clearly a need. And I've always found that whenever some sort of disaster happens, I get the question all the time, how can I help? How can I support? And a lot of times people are like, we're driving to, you know, this city because we just want to help and clean up. And that's not really something that is beneficial. There's a process to get people into places, but dollars go a long way. I mean, that's a huge way where you could be a part of that from the comfort of your home, and you're supporting it. And it doesn't have to be a big dollar amount. I mean, 10, 20 bucks is all it has to be. And so kind of that whole process came to where I just threw up this link to this fund online. It was Tuesday night, and I think I put it up at like 10 p.m. We happened to the next day have a board meeting at 7:30. And there have been conversations about what this might look like, but we've not had either something to take action, or we've not had an official plan, if that makes sense. And I was like, well, trial by error, let's just do it. And so we went to the board meeting the next morning at 7:30. And during the board meeting, we were kind of talking about it. And I was like, hey, bring that Coles County fund up. And I had been texting with Allison the night before as well. And I hate bothering her at night, but clearly I was like, eh, what's going on? Because I know she's connected into that community, Coles County, really well. And so the board meeting, by the next day, I think we had $1,700 in there. And the board was like, wait, what? I was like, yeah, I just put it up on my Facebook page. And I said, we'll get that money to Coles County somehow. And I think that's when people started to actually see the business. You could talk about it, but once you put it into action, people kind of see how that came about. And so the board said, well, let's donate $5,000 and let's make it matching funds. Hopefully people will bring that up and match that $5,000. And then if we get 5,000 donations, suddenly that's 10,000 for Coles County. Through that process, then over time, then there were some other private donors connected to the Community Foundation who put extra matching money. So the fund, I think it ended up being $7,500 of matching funds. And we raised over $10,000 from that. So we were able to send $18,000 just from that effort down to Coles County to help out with that. At the same time, the Southeastern Community Foundation, they made a decision to donate money as well to the cause. And so they sent $27,000. Basically, the next day they activated the fund and said, yep, we want to do this as well. So we were able to send $45,000 to Mattoon. And that doesn't go to individuals, but it goes to other nonprofits in the community. So the Chamber of Commerce Foundation got a large chunk of that money, and the Chamber of Commerce then can do with that money what they see fit. We're not just blindly sending it. The conversations were happening. What's the need? How can this help? Okay, let's put it here. Let's put it there. Let's put it there. And so out of that, there was some additional money that the Chamber Foundation had reached. They were able to give, I think it was 36 businesses were able to get funds to help out with that. Ed Dowd down there, you know, you think of a restaurant. They're closed. They're not able to make any money. They still have rent. They still have bills. They still have salaries. They still have staff, things of that. They were able to make at least, or they were able to at least get something. It's not going to solve everything, but that helps keep them. And for a restaurant, you kind of want to protect those. I mean, it's tough for them already.
Oh, yeah.
Those restaurants provide jobs. They provide a service. And so from the economic side, there was a lot of damage being done there. We also then were able to send $6,000 to accompany that. And then they got more money from other folks. And it was really incredible what was able to happen. And so a lot of the money went to that. There were other places that went. So the Community Foundation of East Central, we made some decisions to put money in other places. One of the other organizations that was talked about, like who's really helping the Salvation Army, we sent them a check. We dropped it off. It was amazing to hear what they were doing and the story they had and how that was going to benefit them. So Lytle Park then was a place where the employees still worked. They kind of operate like a park district. It's kind of unique setup for them, but their employees were handing out water. They were still paying them, even though you couldn't swim at the pool at the park. And so we sent $2,000 to them. And then the last group we sent money to is the Peace Meals. And that's operated in partnership with Sarah Bush Lincoln Hospital System. And the Peace Meals was really important in the area because they were the ones going to door to door in places that people couldn't get out. They were homebound mm-hmm. for one reason or another. You know, the Peace Meals program, I think we all know what that does. It brings meals to seniors and those who are disabled and otherwise can't perhaps have the mobility that the rest of us have. And so they were instrumental to make sure those people had a connection and those people got water during that time as well. So we decided to send $2,000 to them. So it was really cool to see it wasn't a lot of money that we raised, but it was mm-hmm. enough. And I think it made a big difference and a big help for those areas. And so I think it was a great first start. I think what we did was something that was different, unique. And it's almost like crowdfunding. The Community Foundation, they've never really done crowdfunding, but they have the resources and the setup to do that fairly effectively. And so I kind of was like, let's just do it and see what happens. And there's been, I think there's been a lot of positive response internally. I think there's been a lot of positive response on the outside too. So I'm pretty happy mm-hmm. with how things went.
Well, I think it's wonderful because, you know, things like tornadoes and floods, I mean, these things get so much response. And this wasn't on that scale, but it did affect everybody in the town and the surrounding communities. And the fact that it couldn't be, you know, alleviated by boiling the water and people were advised not to give it to their pets. And there's just all sorts of facets that, you know, if you can't take a shower in your water, that's pretty, and you can't drink it, you know, it's just pretty, it's pretty disturbing and disruptive of life. And as you said, senior citizens, people that can't get out or that are homebound and don't have, even though we feel differently because we're connected by the internet, so many people do not have that. They do not have it as because they just don't care or they just don't have those things. And you and Kevin and Amanda, all you guys just have so many followers and you have such a capacity to get the word out to so many people. Do you think that there was, and I love my town, I'm not, Mattoon's my hometown, but you know, everybody can improve things. From what you've seen on your side, do you see that there's anything that they could have done differently to have gotten the word out to more people? I know that the news is a wonderful place to do that, but for those who aren't connected on social media, is there some other way that you think they could have, could improve in the future to get the word out more effectively?
You know, I think a couple of things. One, you can be prepared for a disaster, but until it happens, you really don't know how prepared you are. And it could be things that you aren't prepared for. I'll kind of, in my hometown, Gibson City, my dad's the mayor. He's been there for 25 years. And I hear a lot about, you know, their disaster preparation and things of that. Well, they've had some really major fires up there in recent years. And I don't think they planned for that, but you kind of have to adapt in the moment to that there. So I think if anything, from the emergency preparedness side, I think that this was almost very revealing and that you have to be ready for anything if mm-hmm. you're involved in a community government. And it doesn't matter how big, how small, but if something happens, it could be some sort of major crime. It could be an evacuation notice. And you have to be connected with your partners in there. I can't speak on behalf of Mattoon, and I don't want to say things that aren't, but I think it does show the importance of, okay, we have the framework. We know what to do. And mm-hmm. then when something happens, being able to use that framework there. I don't want to speculate too much. I think they did what they could with what they had in the moment. It was very, it's very tough to communicate that. And I think the timing wasn't great either from that. And something like that as well, you also have to think, okay, this goes for a lot of things, Wendy. It's not about what you say or what you do. It never is. It's always about the optics of it. How does it actually look in the end game? How does it look to the receiver? And that, I think, is something that a lot of, if this happened anywhere else, I think we'd have similar problems and questions. Mm-hmm. The end user, in this case, it's the residents of that town. What does it look like to them? Because that's actually what matters. It doesn't matter what you did, that you communicated. They communicated with media right away. We got the word out. That's what we're supposed to do. They communicated on social media. They called the radio station. You know, they were doing what they can. And in some ways, I think growing up involved in small town government, just being aware of it more, you'll never please everyone. That's maybe something else. But I think it's also a time where you still have to think of what else can they do? And I think those conversations are happening. I have some great conversations with folks that are in the city government of, okay, you know, we've learned this, we've learned that, we know what to do, da, 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 da. And I think that's something that will be some positives that come from that there.
I wondered about that because, you know, a thing like this does expose the vulnerabilities that people know they're there, but they don't realize the extent. There have been boil orders before. There have been things like that, but temporary things. And there have been tastes and smells in the water before that have never resulted in anything like this. But when something like this does happen, then, as I said, those vulnerabilities are exposed. And I guess it maybe took something like this magnitude to make people come together and realize those different agencies that are involved in different things to be more. I don't think you could realize your vulnerabilities until something like this happens, you know, to make a more cohesive way of reaching out to people and making them understand exactly what they need to do, how they need to respond to these things.
Yeah, so it'll be something where, you know, I think too, when you talk about the public's response to it, the city provides the water. And therefore, if they're not providing the water at a high quality, that automatically puts a target on their back, right? Mm-hmm. People have someone to blame in situations like that. If you have a major tornado come through your town or a huge windstorm, you can't really blame the city for that. You can't really blame anyone for that, if that makes sense. Now, I didn't hear the sirens. And well, you know, there's all these ways to get weather alerts. It's, you know, have an app, weather call, sign up for a community text notification, you know, et cetera, et cetera. There's ways that, you know, you can do that. But at the end of the day, a storm comes through, you're kind of at the mercy of that storm. And there's not really any blame. So I do think that also added some additional challenges. And I think that played a role in some of the responses that the public had is, okay, there's someone we can blame for this, right? We're supposed to get clean water from them, and we aren't. Versus a tornado just came through. We're all in trouble, if that makes sense. I think there's two entirely big differences in that. And even thinking of other things, you know, think of Tutopolis when the tanker rolled over. They had to evacuate half the town, and those people passed away. You could place blame. Oh, yeah, the driver that swerved in front of the truck. And but in the immediate aftermath of that, you really couldn't blame the city, if that makes sense. Like there wasn't, it was just the messaging had to get out and people had to leave and you're almost in response mode. So I think there is, from the visual side of things, you know, the optics of a tornado coming through a town versus the optic of my water is now toxic are vastly different to the public.
Exactly.
And that I think did play a role.
Yes. I think that's a thing too, that I believe people need to understand. It's easy for me to say, cause I'm on Clearwater, I'm in the country, and who's to say that the next time something happens, it won't be on Clearwater. I mean, you know, nobody is clear from these things happening. It can happen to anybody, but you know, and I know it's a convenience, when you have a small baby, you know, and you're bathing your child in that water the day before, and then you find out, oh, the water's dangerous. You know, how vulnerable was my child? How in danger were they? So, you know, I realize that there are all these things, but if you put it in perspective, you know, it's more than likely a temporary situation. You will get through it. You will survive. And you know, and then it just, I always felt like it's easy for me to say that because I am on Clearwater. I'm not one of those people that has to deal with hauling water in. Although being in the country, I have hauled water in for many years to getting rural water running through my house. So I just think that in that case, you know, weighing it versus something that is a crisis that's going to affect your towns. You've, as you say, Gibson City, you've had tornadoes and floods and things go through there and affect things that are far more permanent issues, far more permanent scars on a town than something like this. I mean, it came through and it passed, and hopefully they won't have to deal with it again. But you know, it is, and then even again, it's going back to the social media thing, which we've discussed in the past, putting on about what you have about doing the funding and raising the money, then you still get the inevitable responses of the negative things coming from people. So I think that it is important for people to understand that it's not the end of the world. It was a crisis, and it, you know, I feel sorry for anybody who had to go through it, especially the rest of it was Bagel Fest weekend. It couldn't have been a worse time for it to happen, but everybody lived.
Yeah, and thinking as well, you know, we talk about disaster preparedness. One of those things that I think people often don't think about is, you know, you need to have some food and water on hand, right? You know, a couple days of water, a couple days of food. You know, we've got it. We just buy a couple gallon jugs of water and they sit in our pantry. And every year or two, we'll rotate them out, use them if we need, you know, use them if they don't get used for disaster purposes, but in case something like that happens. And I don't think people immediately realize that where, okay, it's really important you have food. What about water, right? You got to have that aspect as well. So I think this probably was a little eye-opening to some people where, yeah, they're going to probably start keeping a pack of bottled water or a couple of gallons. I mean, you know, it's $1.29 for a gallon jug at the store these days. Some places a little more, some places a little less. You get the 5-gallon jugs and it's cheaper per thing. You know, just have one of those that's there. So that to me is something that kind of I find to be something that people often don't think about when it comes to natural disasters and things like that. So I think the other thing as well, in the conversations that I've had and kind of looking big picture at things is, and this happens in any disaster, Wendy, whether it's a tornado, whether it's a fire in your house, whether it's a flood, you know, that's a huge emotional response that you have to those types of things. You know, you've just lost all your belongings. You've just lost the ability to, you know, have water. Your power goes out. You don't have the ability to, you know, cook food, eat food, open your fridge. You're going to lose all that. So when there's a cost that affects people, they have an emotional response, and they have every right to have that emotional response. Mm-hmm. But a lot of times for some people, that emotional response manifests to anger, and you kind of see that take hold in some ways. And certain things, they're angry more than others. I think the water crisis, because there was somebody immediate to blame. Wow, the city must have messed up. If you have hot weather and heavy rain and that big toxic algae bloom, that's still going to happen. Now, are there things the city can do in the future? Absolutely. I think they're learning that now. But you're going to have that manifest itself no matter what. A tornado comes through. Okay, you lost a lot of things. It's very emotional. It's a little harder to get angry at someone for having that happen to you. But you might get angry at the recovery efforts. You might get angry at that because something didn't happen quick enough or there wasn't enough funding there. Or you know, there's always going to be that as a part of things. And I can't blame people for that. I'm never going to attack them for being angry because it's hard when you lose everything, right? That's such an emotional response. So there were some comments and things of that. And it's like, okay, you know, they're going through a really difficult time. That's clearly what it is there. There's some people too that were from the outside looking in from the comfort of their basement. They were drinking clean tap water and cook smells and commenting on things or, you know, from afar. They were in Charleston and being keyboard warriors and saying things like that. And sometimes I wanted to be like, okay, you're saying this and this is what the money should be used for. Did you donate $10? Did you chip in $20 to help out? If not, I don't think you have really a place to say much at all. Things of that. But I think there's two sides of that. There's people directly affected. And of course, there's always people who have an opinion and an idea from far away and love to comment on things.
Well, speaking of angry people and social media and people who want to comment on things, you have people like your Eddie, who recently said, I don't give a flying F about your severe weather. Get Big Brother 27 on the TV at WCIA 3. And they're switching to the weather itself and the vital importance that meteorologists play in getting the word out to people. I know you have to just brush it off and say, okay, you know, it's for the greater good. You have to satisfy and try to satisfy the people whose lives you're trying to save. You know, odds are maybe a storm will pass over, but if it doesn't and there are people in danger and it's happened many times before, you know, you just, how do you, you post those things and then you get a lot of feedback from people who understand to some extent what you're trying to say by posting that.
Yeah, I think one, it's kind of fun to post because I like to, I never try and reveal their names or anything, but it's just like, yep, we are surrounded by these people and they live in our communities and they come to the same things we do, but not they're out there. You know, at the end of the day, it doesn't bother me all that much anymore. And I'm honestly with that one, I more posted that because I was like, people still watch and like Big Brother? Is that like that? I mean, I can tell you what happens. Somebody said something which offended someone, and somebody slept with someone which offended someone, and somebody kissed someone which, I mean, like, it's just drama is what it is, right? Yeah. That's all it is. Like, shoot. But I guess Eddie was really into that show. And, you know, sorry, but.
Eddie, it's just not your week. That's all there was to it. Poor Eddie. But, you know, I spoke with Amanda Brennan last week, and I'd like to move on to a new program that you guys have, your teacher focus group. I think that's another thing so exciting and holds a lot of promise for the community that you guys are doing. So could you address that a little bit?
Sure. Yeah.
I think it's wonderful. Teachers are kind of... Education's under fire anyway on so many fronts. So please tell us about that.
Sure. So I kind of have an education background with my undergrad. I was going to be an ag teacher. And so, you know, I've always wanted to do more in education. And I think there's a couple of things that come from that. First off, one, teachers in communities, they kind of know things and they kind of have the, you know, they're kind of the, I don't say that the brains of the community, but they kind of have the pulse in the community. What's going on in town? What's going on in the school? And so we can get some info and ideas from them on what's happening. Because there's teachers everywhere, right? Every town has teachers. Mm-hmm. Doesn't matter if you're big, small, whatnot. I think the other thing is that with education perhaps being a little more in the spotlight, as you've said, you know, what are the issues affecting our schools? What are the issues affecting your community? That's going to help our education reporting side of things. I also think that from a little bit more of a selfish perspective, it's just going to be really cool to have conversations with teachers from all different areas. We're sending out the invites. We had over 100 people that wanted to be on. I didn't expect that kind of response, and we can only have so many. But it's going to be really cool to have people from different backgrounds and walks of life and experiences kind of in the same room. Like, I'm really looking forward to that. Just to hear what's going on and hear what they're dealing with and things of that. And then also, teachers are teaching the generation that is not watching local news. Folks in your generation, Wendy, and my generation, you know, we're pretty plugged into local news, and we, you know, either watch it on TV or we grew up watching it in some way, shape, or form. Like, kids today are not that connected with that. And if local news is going to have any bit of survivability, we've got to figure out ways to integrate that more into the curriculum, especially given the fact that a lot of small town journalism is disappearing. The local newspapers that are drying up, and now there's, you know, areas that don't have any local journalism. And we have some of those here in Central Illinois. In some ways, schools could be a chance to fill in that gap with journalism classes and things of that. There's some really strong journalism programs out there in Central Illinois that I think would be really great to learn from and say, okay, what are you doing? And how can you be a part of telling the stories that are in your community that are going on? Now, you know, at WCIA, we have 300 towns, and we have only so many reporters and so many anchors and only so much time on TV to tell these stories. But if something big is going on, these schools typically have some sort of impact by it. If there's a car crash that affects a family, there's a chance that that family's got a kid in that school, right? If there's a fire in the community, somebody could be affected that's connected to that school. So it's kind of neat to try and tap into this and see what happens. I don't want to speculate a whole lot because I don't really know entirely what's going to come from that, but I'm just really looking forward to the idea of soaking up what people, what the schools are doing and what could come from that. And so I think there's going to be a lot of benefit there.
Well, I think it's wonderful for, number one, for teachers to get a voice because they so often, you know, are kind of shoved aside. People just don't give them the credit for doing what they're doing, and not just being teachers, but in many cases being social workers as well, trying to deal with, they know what kid comes in hungry, they know what kid comes in, you know, dirty and doesn't have a good environment and doesn't have a good home life. They see that every day. So there's so much more involved in being a teacher than just being a teacher. It's a such a multifaceted job anymore, and so deeply unappreciated that I'm surprised you didn't have more than 100 people wanting to take part in that focus group, because I think that you'll really have some, that'll have some tentacles coming out of that.
Well, okay, so we only had 100 people because I posted once on my Facebook page and Amanda Brennan shared it, and we talked about, oh, we'll put it on the station website and we'll have the station media social media share and things like that, and like keep it going. But in the first 3 hours, we had 50 people. And I was like, oh my goodness, that's a lot of applications that we're going to have to go through. Let's just kind of let it organically filter. And, you know, it's our first year. We don't quite know what it's going to be. And we don't know if it'll continue. But let's just see what comes from this. And so I'm sure if more people heard about it, then we'd get more applications. But we kind of were like, okay, we're only talking 10 to 12 people here. We already, in a couple of days, it was like 90 people. I was like, okay. we clearly have a large sample size here. We could keep promoting it, but that just makes it to where we have to sort through more candidates. And maybe we should have shared it more and give more people a chance, but we're just getting our feet wet with this idea and we'll see what comes from it. And and the group that we have too, that we'll have coming, that we're inviting, is very diverse. I mean, there's big city schools, there's small schools, there's high school, there's elementary school, there's folks that work in special education, there's administrators, there's a college professor that's getting an invite. So it's going to be a very diverse group as well, which would be kind of neat that we're able to cover all of the areas that we wanted to. We're not just, oh, it's all, you know, high school science teachers that are all coming. Like, it's going to be really neat, the blend of folks that we get in the same room.
Well, I think that that's part of what separates WCIA from so many other stations is that community involvement, and you guys do it in so many areas. And I just think that's what makes it unique in getting out and being involved. And the other part I wanted to touch on is the new app that you guys have. That's another way, the streaming app. That, I think, is really cool. And I don't know, do any other stations around have that?
So the new app that we have, the WCIA Plus Digital, it is going to be the WCIA 3 Plus streaming app. It's a way to just expand our footprint with people cutting cords, cable kind of not, you know, cable TV and cable companies have been seeing customers leave for years and years. I mean, there's been a decline in that. It's just, you know, in our house, when we turn on the TV, we're turning on Netflix or we're turning on Apple TV and streaming stuff. And so this is a way to get plugged in more of that. It's a big movement in the TV industry. I think right now, TV is in a digital revolution. In 5 years, it's going to look tremendously different what we do. And it'll be very interesting to see how it plays out. So, you know, there may come a time where WCIA is more commonly streamed digitally than we are on cable and antenna, if the vision comes to fruition and things of that, there, you know, things may look a lot more different than that. And so what that exactly looks like, I don't think anyone knows, but we recognize that our traditional methods of being watched isn't working anymore. And it's diminishing. So this is our chance to expand on that. And it's really cool as well, where our station, it's not just newscasts. I mean, there's different shows that we're doing internally on there. So Jennifer Roscoe has a cooking show that she's doing on there. It's really fascinating. For an hour, they bring in a chef and they cook a dish and they, did you like it?
I loved it. And I kept thinking, okay, well, this is, you know, they're going to have their 5 minute soundbite and then it's going to be gone. And then, you know, and then it's going to be gone and it wasn't gone. And to see Jennifer be able to, you know, have her time and ask all the questions you want to ask in that time frame. I mean, you know, you don't get that time on the news.
Yeah, so it's just a way to add extra content that we're already getting and then create new content that we think people might like. And so, you know, people are streaming a Netflix show, well, they might start streaming the WCIA 3 Plus shows as options to watch at home. And that's kind of neat that we get to have some creativity. There's a weather podcast Kevin's doing. Sports has a podcast that they're doing. And I say podcast, it's a digital show. It's a, you know, it's an audio and video podcast style show. There are some conversations that some of our anchors do, and there's Chat with the Chiefs, and there are some other stories and things that they get to spend more time on and kind of dig in on things. There'll probably be an ag show coming soon. There'll be some other stuff. And so just a neat way to have local content and things that people might resonate or plug in with. And then, of course, our newscast will stream on that as regulars in addition. So people who don't have cable, they can, you know, log on to their Roku and download the app and watch our newscast live now, which is really great. It's really fun because, as an example, my dentist, of all people, told me, he said he was tickled pink about this new app. The only reason they had YouTube TV was so they could have WCIA. And he's like, now we can get YouTube TV, so we're saving money. And I'm like, okay, that's great. I think that's a good thing. so, you know, just it's a free app. You don't pay so much a month for it. It's free, you download it, you get all the content that you would get over the air and on cable through that as well. So,
and I know a lot of people ask the question, will those ever be available on, you know, Apple phones or Android phones? Is that ever something that would come to that? Or is it just something strictly on the streaming services?
Technically, a lot of what's going on there is available for Apple and Android. If you download the news app, you can stream the newscasts now on those when they happen. And so those stuff, when they're streamed, go on there. What separates it from the streaming app, from the way I understand it, is that you can also stream those shows on demand. You can't necessarily do that through the news app. So okay. I don't think the cooking shows and that stuff is going on to the news app, but eventually I think it will come to where you'll see either a new app or an expansion of the existing app to include those things on. We're kind of doing phased increases. You know, the first phase was get this app out for Apple TV, Amazon Fire Stick, and Roku. Next phase might incorporate that. I'm not paid enough to know exactly what that looks like. You know, my paycheck is too small compared to the higher ups, but I know that those conversations are being had on how to expand that.
Well, I think it's wonderful that WCIA is looking forward like that, and not, especially in light of so many other stations, you know, dropping people, and just it seems like there are a lot of cost-cutting measures that are really more harmful than they are helpful. And it seems like WCIA just is looking forward all the time and being more progressive.
Yeah, it's a really tough time for TV broadcast and journalism now, because advertising dollars are down. And if you think of all these streaming services, what used to be a very linear mode, and people turn on the news, and that's where that is. Those dollars are being spread among so many sources. So in some places, a TV station to survive has to make cuts. And we've seen that with some stations across the Midwest, even down in Indiana, there's been a number of stations like that. And for one reason or another, there's different factors that play a role in that. But if TV stations don't evolve like what we're trying to do now, you know, maybe this works and things turn out great and we're able to stay. But it's clear we can't just keep doing the same thing over and over again, because we're in a new age right now. And so I'm really excited for how this digital thing works. I'm very hopeful for it. And I think it'll be good, because we kind of need to protect local journalism. And TV stations, oftentimes for many communities, are the source of local journalism, especially with what's happened to radio stations and newspapers and things like that. You're kind of seeing the legacy media change. And so this is a way to kind of adapt to what is coming and what is new. And in some cases, what's already here.
Well, I feel like, you know, my age, I mean, I'm 73 years old. I'm not a kid, but I'm so lucky that I've gotten to see these changes and to try to be a person to evolve and embrace those changes and see what's coming, rather than just say, that's not for me. I don't understand those things, but I want to try to understand. I don't understand the technical side of it, but I do understand that things need to change and evolve with the times, because it is such a tough time for journalism in general and for journalists. It's a strange world to be in. So I have want to end up with just a couple of quick things before you go, because I know your time is so valuable. But how is Vinny? You guys going to have a vacationing the Dickies with Vinny on vacation or something? You guys going to be doing that on this new app?
Yeah, I don't know. We would we'll have to figure something out. Maybe it'd be fine. I mean, he's just a little character. He's a little turd right now. He costs us a little money eating some copper wire, but he's still a puppy, and we're still figuring things out. And he's fine. He's totally fine. My wallet is not, but he's about the best little boy we could ask for. And he loves car rides. He loves going places. He's super smart with his words and knowing people's names and things like that. He can pick up on a lot. You know, he's only eight, nine months now, and we can't say treat. And we're getting to the point where he can't even spell it out, because he knows what that means. And he knows what a certain brand of treat is. He knows the word greenies, because he loves those. He knows what cheese means and all these things like that. So he's very language oriented, which is kind of fun. But
that's fun.
Yeah, he's good. We'll keep that's posting funny. Him on Facebook, too. That's where I tend to share a lot of things about him.
Well, sure. Has he met the Dickey Chicks yet? I know he surely has met them.
Yes, he has. And he likes to look at them. And he'll be on the other side of the fence that they're on. And he doesn't really know what to do. We have a lot of geese and duck in the parks and whatnot. And he kind of likes to chase the geese. We've trained him that the ducks are good. We like them. The geese, we're okay with him being a little bit bratty towards. But, he never catches them. We never let him do any of that stuff. But he'll kind of jump at them a little bit. But he's really nice about the ducks. The chickens, he just kind of looked at them. He's like, oh, okay. That's... those are big birds there. And he's a couple feet away from them, because they're all staring back at him too. And they're pretty fearless as well. So he's kind of like, they're not running from me. So maybe I'm not supposed to chase them.
So one last question. Have he and Boston, the station dog, met yet?
No, they've not been in the same time, in the same room at the same time. Maybe one day that'll happen. Boston's a good dog too. Boston is very, you know, very disciplined. I mean, his boss or his owner, Darren, Boston's owner, Darren, did a really good job training him and super smart. I think they'd be friends, but for now, we'll make that happen one day.
Well, when Stacy and I would be singing on CI Living, you know, occasionally pass through the newsroom there to go to the bathroom. And the first time I went through there, I saw the dog. It's like, oh, there's a dog. And such a sweet dog. Oh, my gosh. Yeah, that was quite.
He really is.
Yeah, well, thank you, Jacobs. Thank you so much for taking the time. We've had a couple issues here getting connected, disconnected. And it's been such a pleasure to have you here, as always, and for enlightening about the Mattoon Do Not Drink order and about the Community Foundation, all the things you're involved in the app, everything. Thank you so much for your time.
Yeah, thanks for having me. And it'll be exciting. I think there's a lot of things we've learned as well from the Mattoon, the fundraising efforts, and it'll be some potential in the future to see that grow and expand for different scenarios and situations. So for first time, really happy with how it went and overall very pleased with the public reception. So that might be something that evolves and grows as we move forth.
Well, I'm sorry that it took something like that, but I'm glad that you're able to use my hometown as your maiden voyage for that adventure.
I'm a little tired of Coles County news stuff. So if you could keep it tame down there, Wendy, we'd appreciate that.
Well, I'm in the far northwest corner. I can't control anything. I can't even control Stacy here. So, you know, it's all I can, all I'm doing, you know, I'm at my maximum capabilities.
Yeah. Keep them away from that Wi-Fi router when you're on your shows, will you?
Yeah, I'll do the best I can. Thanks again, Jacob Dickey, for being on Life on the Illinois Prairie. And thank you for listening, everyone. And please be kind. Thanks for listening to Life on the Illinois Prairie, the undercurrents of our American life. If you haven't yet, go ahead and subscribe to Life on the Illinois Prairie wherever you get your podcast. Stay tuned for more stories, interviews, and updates. I'm your host, Wendy Fleming Dexter. Until next time.
Produced by Audavita Studios. Connect your voice to the world.